Now, UW-Madison is responding to a sharp uptick in COVID-19 cases by holding all classes online for the next 2 weeks. It's also quarantining students in two of its largest dorms. Yesterday's announcement came on the fifth day of classes. The student positivity rate was at least 20% on Monday and Tuesday, 13% yesterday. Public health officials say there are at least 46 outbreaks tied to UW-Madison. Other UW campuses are seeing increases in COVID as well. Meanwhile, a model from San Diego State University estimates that 19% of all U.S. coronavirus cases in August could be traced back to the Sturgis motorcycle rally in South Dakota. South Dakota's governor called the report fiction, saying it's built on faulty assumptions and was not peer-reviewed. Mary Beth Graham is an infectious disease specialist with the Medical College of Wisconsin. She's also medical director of infection prevention and control at Frederick Hospital. Dr. Graham, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, first of all, let's start with what we're seeing on campuses. What's your reaction to news, not just here in Wisconsin, but on campuses around the country that are seeing big increases in COVID as they come back to school?
I guess I don't want to sound flippant by saying it this way, but this isn't unexpected. We know that this virus is circulating in the community. We know that it is incredibly easily transmitted. We also know that the average college student is probably unlikely to follow a lot of the mitigation, you know, things that they're supposed to do with regards to with social distancing, gathering, wearing a mask, et cetera. So having my youngest child is actually a UW-Madison student. And 2 weeks ago when we were there on campus, there were students everywhere, all over, out in the green areas, no mask in sight, playing Frisbee, running around, having fun, no social distancing. They're doing what college students do. So it's just not unexpected. And the two dorms at UW-Madison typically have a large number of freshmen in them. So it's the two that I read about online that are there that are quarantined. Again, it doesn't surprise me. It's disappointing because one would hope that there would have been a little bit more attention to the recommendations for social distancing and wearing a mask, et cetera. But I'm not surprised.
This is campuses, but there are other super spreader events, so-called, that we've seen around the country. Are you, I guess, dismayed that we haven't gotten the lesson? Like, if we wore the masks, if we social distance better, try to be outside more than inside, that kind of thing, we could be making a difference in all this, right?
So there's a lot about COVID right now that, again, having watched this closely, been involved in a number of trials and monitoring and taking care of patients from the beginning. The virus has changed over the last 6 to 9 months. I mean, since basically in January when we were looking at this. And there's a couple of different ways to look at it. We know the virus isn't going to go away. So anybody who says it's just going to go away just needs to quit saying that, because it's not. But the virus has changed, and the manifestations and the presentations that we are seeing have definitely changed from early on in the pandemic. If you look at laboratory confirmed COVID-19 associated hospitalizations, those are going down fairly steadily over the last several months, where I think right now, at least on the CDC website, it's about the rate per 100,000 population was down to about 3, whereas you had previously it was up in the 10, 12, 15 range. So, I mean, that's actually a good sign that the virus actually has changed. There are different strains that are circulating, much more transmissible than the earlier strains that we saw, but we're seeing a different demographic. So we're seeing younger people getting ill, but we still have to worry about those individuals potentially exposing those whose immune systems may not be as healthy. And even with the young people, we're still seeing young people who can have severe cases, have significant complications, and can also still die from this. So it shouldn't be taken lightly. I mean, I worry about students who get this and they're like, oh, I just had a fever for a day or two. It was no big deal. and then other students like, yeah, I don't need to worry about this and go out. There's going to be, you know, potentially there are those people that don't have that as their response to being affected with the virus. That's why, again, everybody working together to try to prevent spread is so important.
Now, on what I think might be an upside here, have we learned a lot since the early sort of nightmare scenario in the New York metropolitan area about preventing the rapid spread in senior centers, health facilities, especially for older or other vulnerable populations? It seems like we've gotten better at that.
Oh, definitely. I mean, the state of Wisconsin has a has some really nice protocols outlined where, again, they look at, these are some of our most vulnerable populations, and they have protocols put together where employees are screened on a routine basis for who work in congregate settings, whether it's a skilled nursing facility, nursing home, et cetera. Because again, you don't want somebody who's asymptomatic, who could come in and then potentially spread, and then much better adherence and knowing now. I mean, early on in the pandemic, we weren't doing universal, what we call PPE or personal protective equipment. And now for all patient-facing encounters in healthcare, it essentially is at a minimum, surgical mask, eye protection or goggles, not just eyeglasses and gloves, and also always making sure that you do very, very, very good hand hygiene. Early on, that wasn't what we were doing because early on, I mean, and many physicians and physicians at CDC, Dr. Fauci has said this, I've said this, we were wrong at the beginning because we thought this virus was going to be very similar to influenza, where it was mostly droplet, the 6 feet, you could manage it for, if you were less, you know, more than 6 feet, there wouldn't be an issue. Then we learned that, no, this virus actually does have the potential in some scenarios to remain viable in smaller droplets that can remain in the air longer and travel further than that 6 feet. So much has been learned about this virus. And again, I think one of the most telling scenarios was the choir thing in Washington State from several months ago, where one person was sick and so many people became ill. And I remember after that, a lot of us, my infectious disease colleagues, we all looked at each other and said, oh man, this is not like flu. It doesn't spread like that. And then again, further studies were done in terms of how it could be spread. So the knowledge curve about this virus, how it's spread, what you can do to do mitigation has just exploded. The amount of data that's out there, the articles that have been written, it's fascinating. As a healthcare professional, it's fascinating to live through this and see this accumulation of data. And then also on the science side, looking at it in terms of what do we know about this virus? How can we fight it? What therapeutics can we use? How do we go after the vaccine, et cetera? It's really an amazing time in, at least, again, for medical professionals, it's an amazing time to be in the midst of this and to watch this evolve.
Talking to Dr. Mary Beth Graham, infectious disease specialist at the Medical College of Wisconsin, also with Frederick Hospital, talking about latest on COVID-19, how it spreads, big spreading potential events. You can join in with your questions, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. What I remember hearing about a while ago is the COVID-19 virus will die on dry fabrics or even dry surfaces in about 24 hours. But I have a scenario for you. I went to five places yesterday. So in my car, if I picked up COVID-19 somewhere and I go out driving tomorrow, how likely is the COVID-19 that might be in my car, how likely is that still be alive in the damp, because of the damp weather we had yesterday?
Dennis, thanks for the call. A lot of questions about still the idea of surface transmission and picking it up from surfaces. Dr. Graham, what do we know about that in general and his scenario, I guess, in particular?
No, thank you for the question. So there has been a lot written about the viability of the virus on different types of surfaces, whether it's cardboard versus plastic versus something else. But the only way that that virus actually is going to get into you and infect you is if you touch those surfaces and then touch your nose or your mouth. So the way I've chosen to look at it is, it's not so much that they'll be on a surface, but you should always think about, after you touch something, before you touch your face and your mouth, you should do some type of hand hygiene. I keep a bottle of alcohol hand sanitizer in my car. After I'm in at the grocery store and I come out and put everything in my car, as soon as I get in the car, I alcohol hand sanitize, then I come on home and everything's good. After I put up my groceries, I do that. And I'm very thoughtful about, am I going to be going near my mouth or my nose, because that's how you're going to get exposed to it. So even from the, you know, you could sit there and say there'd be many scenarios, how long does it live? That becomes an irrelevant question if you remember the only way that you are going to get it into an area where then it could take hold is if it gets to one of your mucous membranes, your mouth, your nose. So it's those hands, it's that hand sanitizing before you go close to your face.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking about how COVID-19 spreads at large gatherings and elsewhere. Dr. Mary Beth Graham is with us, infectious disease specialist at the Medical College of Wisconsin, also medical director of infection prevention and control at Froedtert Hospital. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How concerned are you about the rise in COVID-19 cases on college campuses? Are you on one of those campuses now? As a student yourself or faculty or staff, what's going on where you are? Are you worried? Was it a mistake to come back at all, or was it a good choice, do you think? And do you have general COVID-related questions for our guest doctor? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett. We continue our conversation about the spread of COVID-19 with Dr. Mary Beth Graham, infectious disease specialist at the Medical College of Wisconsin and medical director of infection prevention and control at Froedtert Hospital. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about COVID, how it works, how it spreads, and how we can stop the spread? Anything you've been wondering about masks, potential vaccines, and more? Have you been avoiding big crowds, indoors or outdoors? Have you tried to hold a gathering of some sort? How did you do it? And what do you think of what's going on campuses, especially if you are on a campus now yourself? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll go back to your calls. Andrew is with us in Whitewater. Andrew, hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Andrew?
So one of the questions that I wanted to ask was if the doctor who's on right now, if she happens to know what the death rate in nursing homes was and what percentage of the death nationwide that accounts for. And the other question or point that I have is, given that nursing homes were locked down almost immediately, how effective of a, I guess, preventative measure is that when we've seen what's happened with infection rates and death rates in nursing homes?
Thanks for the call, Andrew. Dr. Graham, nursing homes and COVID.
So the biggest issue with nursing homes initially, especially early on in the pandemic, is that there was spread within the facilities, and essentially patients were kept there when they were sick early on, but not sick enough to go to the hospital. So then more people became ill. So in terms of death rates that are split out to that, I mean, the CDC has some of the best data, if you want to look at it, to look at death rates and the ages of those individuals which have been affected. I've never seen a table that specifically comes out and splits it out according to was a nursing home resident versus not. They do have it by age. They do have it by gender. They do have it by race. There's a lot out there. But a lot of the, the initial issues with the nursing homes were in a congregate setting, and it's basically a closed environment, and you had people there. It was just incredibly unfortunate at the beginning of the pandemic. A lot of the facilities changed what they do. So I know that some of our facilities around here were very very quick that they actually had COVID. They switched and had COVID units so people weren't sick enough to go to the hospital. They changed the PPE that they wear there, so the employees changed what they did. They were very, very, quick to, after we had additional information about the virus, to change some of those practices. We did not see here what was originally seen in Washington State or what was seen in New York State. But again, I apologize. I haven't seen anything specifically from nursing homes, but if you look at populations, the age, yes, the older patients, the more debilitated patients, those typically would be patients that would be in that demographic. They have had some of the highest rates of attack rates, but also deaths.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Sarah with us in Eau Claire. Sarah, hi.
Hi there.
What do you want to bring? Tell us about?
Yeah, I'm a student at Eau Claire currently, and UW-Eau Claire, and our current issue is off-campus students who are going out to the bars. And I was wondering if there's a way that campuses can control off-campus students so that we can lessen the spread that way.
Sarah, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Grab, do you have thoughts anyway?
Actually, I heard somebody, it was a blurb on one of the, when I was flopping through and going through on my computer, and it said, essentially, open the schools and close the bars. I mean, essentially, that was the recommendation. And I love that mantra, and that's still my mantra. I saw it several months ago. It's very, very difficult to control human behavior. It's just hard to control. I mean, you can tell everybody what the right thing to do is, but making people do that's unclear. Some colleges have very, very strict disciplinary actions because if they're finding out, I mean, I've read reports of students being suspended for school for a semester, but still paying for that semester at different places. The schools can do what they, are going to have those rules out there, but it's hard. I hate to say it. I mean, people need to be altruistic. It's not about them. It's not about you. You're doing this for other people. So again, when people do this, you're ruining it for somebody else. And I've seen some interviews with students at campuses who are very upset saying, other people who wouldn't follow the rules ruined it for the rest of us. My son he's the son of an infectious disease physician. So he knows all about this. He's ticked. That at Madison, everything has gone back to online learning. And it's the frustration of, again, it's other people think more about themselves than they do think about those around. Actually, just as an aside, I'm just going to throw this in here. And I shared this earlier with somebody back with the 1918 influenza pandemic. There was a news article in Alaska and one of the newspapers there that said the do's and don'ts of influenza prevention. But one of the things was do not neglect your mask was on there. Do not disregard the advice of a specialist just because you don't understand. Do not disregard the rights of a community. Obey cheerfully the rules issued by the authorities. Do not think you are entitled to special privileges. I mean, those are three of the things that people were saying and publishing back in 1918. And if we think back to 1918, there were almost 50 million deaths worldwide from the H1N1 Spanish flu. So again, people were wearing masks, they were doing a lot of things that we're trying to do here. And I'm presuming they had the same things we're dealing with. Is it people who just didn't think it related to them or everybody else can do that, but it doesn't apply to me. It applies to all of us.
Let's bring out another caller now. Jane is with us in Brookfield. Jane, hello.
Hi, my question is, if you can catch the virus at more than 6 feet, why do we keep persisting to say 6 feet? Why aren't we saying 8 to 10 feet?
Interesting. Dr. Graham?
No, that's a great question. It's absolutely a great question. So the issue is the way that so the 6 feet that they talk about, the way that we are mitigating that, it's the masking. So we want people to be wearing to be wearing masks when they're in groups of people that they otherwise don't normally work with or live with. So if you're at home, you don't need to do it. But in essence, when you're in the grocery store wearing the mask there, if you go to church wearing a mask while you're in church, regardless of how far away you are from somebody else, et cetera. Not everybody, so not all instances with the virus being spread, does it spread more than the 6 feet? Again, they talk about a lot depends on how loud somebody's talking. Yelling potentially can project those respiratory droplets further than just the 6 feet of normal talking. And then there are some people, you'll read about it, they're referred to as super shedder or super spreader. It's referred to as both events, where you may have somebody who has a really large viral load, but it's much easier that for those individuals, there's just something about when they are either talking or singing or doing something that the droplets spread further. So the mitigation for that is the mask. And the issue of the masking in the outside of a hospital setting, I mean, we wear them all the time. All of our patient-facing procedures, we're wearing a mask. But they've learned more about what type of mask in the community are much more effective. So the gaiters, essentially, which pull up from your neck, those are not recommended as a really good way to prevent those respiratory droplets from spreading. If possible, the cloth mask that you wear should have a minimum, but actually optimally, three layers. So if it's the two layer and you can put the filter in between, or a minimum of a three layer mask, that's what has been recommended most recently. Again, those are evolving recommendations that are out there, but that's really the biggest issue, again, with helping that. So whether it's the 6 feet, the 26 feet, whatever it ends up being, wearing those masks, especially inside. Outside, it's a little bit different. Again, if there's groups of people, like an outdoor wedding, I would still say, please wear your mask.
And I'll have to jump in there, Dr. Graham. We are all out of time. Thanks so much to our guest, Dr. Mary Beth Graham from the Medical College of Wisconsin and Frederick Hospital, joining us with some of the latest answers to questions about COVID.